The Guardian.
Hello, I'm John Dennis, and this is Guardian Weekly for Wednesday, March the 12th, with news and analysis from our team of reporters and commentators. This week, Europe's leaders gather in Brussels to discuss the effects of climate change, including possible conflict with Russia over energy resources.
What it shows is how climate change has moved up the agenda with a reference to what's going on in the Arctic, whether we can climate-proof the existing rules of the game.
In Zimbabwe, a challenge to President Robert Mugabe from his former finance minister.
I think Mr. Mugabe must be worried. He can't be certain that whatever rigging takes place will necessarily be in his favour and not in Mr. Makone's.
And as Prince Charles imports his model village Poundbury into Jamaica, those trying to regenerate the capital Kingston struggle with gang violence.
1976 to 1980, there was a big political warfare here, and it divided the community into north and south.
How should Europe prepare itself for the effects of climate change? European heads of government meet in Brussels at the end of this week to discuss just that, and they'll receive a report from the EU's head of foreign policy, Javier Solana. It says that the areas worst hit by climate change, including North Africa and the Middle East, will suffer food and water shortages, political instability and war. Millions will want to migrate to Europe, and Europe will face intense competition for energy resources in areas such as the Arctic. This could even flare up into violent conflict. Professor John Vogler from Kiel University is a specialist in the EU's external relations. Professor Vogler, this report paints an alarming picture.
It brings together a number of things that have been in the literature for some time. The problems of resource conflict, migration, pressure on resources and territory that are likely to occur and indeed are occurring because of the impact of climate change. So it conceptualizes them as, quote, a threat multiplier. In some ways, it moves on from the security strategy he produced back in 2003. But the focus is still on armed conflict, territory, the traditional issues of foreign policy and defense policy. What it shows is how climate change has moved up the agenda, because if you read this in terms of what Solana was talking about 5 years ago, there has been a real change in the urgency with which climate change is viewed. And I think it's summed up last year when the British put a resolution to the Security Council on climate change.
And it's interesting as well that in the next NATO summit, the issue of energy security is on the agenda there.
That's right. But in a sense, that's inevitable because of the changes that have occurred, the revival of Russia and Russia's energy power, if you like. What we don't have here, however, is a fundamental reconceptualization of what security means. And I don't think we've got it because we're still thinking of the effects of climate change in a rather orthodox way. If we were to have that, we would start to perhaps think about transferring resources from military activity, from defending against some of these threats, to attempts at mitigation of climate change and adaptation to climate change. Because in many ways, a lot of these debates are about the allocation of resources. And one of the reasons why people in green politics go on about environmental security is because they think these kind of threats are more important than orthodox security threats. If you look at the amount that governments spend on military expenditure, there is a really big gap still.
Although, presumably, the effects of climate change are, as you said earlier, already beginning to be felt. So, to a certain extent, great, we can have our targets on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but we also need to do other things as well.
Yes, I think increasingly that's the case, because in the Climate Change Convention, they now talk quite a lot about adaptation rather than trying to hold back climate change. The other interesting thing about this, I think, is what exactly the European Union can do about it. What Solana is proposing is a relatively modest set of measures involving building up European Union capacities. For instance, they have a satellite system called Global Monitoring for Environment and Security. He's proposing more of that. He's proposing what he calls carbon diplomacy, which involves a greater emphasis on focused research on security hotspots in Africa and elsewhere, and also with a reference, I think, to what's going on in the Arctic, whether we can climate-proof the existing rules of the game. Now, there is a real difference still between what the EU can do in these areas, which are areas of the common foreign security and defence policy, and what it is already doing in efforts to directly deal with the problem of climate change. It's relatively weak as an international actor in its common foreign security policy. It doesn't really set the agenda. But if you then look at, for instance, the Kyoto process and the evolution of the climate regime, there the EU is absolutely central. It has set the agenda for a long time now, and it's taken on the United States and got the ratification of the protocol and so on and so forth. So there is a real distinction here between, if you like, EU foreign policy and EU climate policy, one of which is very intergovernmental, which is the bit that Solana is responsible for, and the other, well, there is a degree of community competence. The EU is much stronger and very much, I think, an international leader in that area.
The EU is a major emitter of carbon. It's also one of the wealthiest regions of the world. Do you think that its leaders recognise any ethical responsibility to countries most affected by climate change, which also tend to be among the poorest countries in the world?
Well, they say they do. If you put together the amount of aid to Africa and elsewhere that the community gives, with all the things the member states do, the European Union is by far and away the biggest aid donor in the world. And it's always been one of the strongest things that the EU does in international politics. Again, much stronger than what it does in the area of the common foreign security policy. Obviously, there's a self-interest dimension in all of this, but there has been an ethical dimension, I think. And they will talk about climate change, I think, in this way as well.
The Lisbon Treaty that was signed at the end of last year allows Europe to have a more focused and united foreign policy. How does that play into these challenges that have been outlined by Javier Solana?
I think it's exactly relevant, because the problem has been, as I've said, is the division between the rather powerful role that the European Union can have when it's acting under community competence and the weakness of the common and foreign security policy, and also the rotating presidency, which makes the effectiveness of EU action rather dependent on who's got the presidency. Now, what the Lisbon Treaty does is to do away with the rotating presidency, so you've got a single international focus, but also it brings together Solana's role with the role of the External Relations Commissioner, which have always been divided. So, in effect, you could see the Lisbon Treaty as making the EU rather more effective in areas like this.
Professor Vogler, many thanks for talking to us. Next week in the print edition of The Guardian Weekly, you can read a special supplement looking at water and the problems facing areas of the world where there isn't enough of it. Sign up for 4 free copies of Guardian Weekly at guardianweekly.co.uk. Zimbabwe goes to the polls on March the 29th. Western election monitors have been banned, but the opponents of President Robert Mugabe claim that with hyperinflation, mass unemployment and hunger, he can't win unless he rigs the vote. Chris McGreal's our Africa correspondent. He's just returned from Zimbabwe. Chris, what's life like for people there at the moment?
Extremely difficult for very large numbers of people. There's about 80% unemployment. So many people are surviving in a sort of netherworld of black market dealings in which they are able to often only provide one meal a day for their families. There's a lot of malnourishment. The World Food Programme estimates that 45% of the population is suffering chronic malnourishment. And the agricultural harvest this year looks as though it is again going to be a huge failure. People are wondering how they're going to feed their families in the months to come.
What do Robert Mugabe and his government say about the conditions facing their people?
Well, Robert Mugabe has for the first time admitted that there is a food crisis. Up until now, he's denied it, and his government said that this year will produce the mother of all harvests, as they put it. They're now facing up to the fact it's probably going to fall 70% short of what Zimbabwe was producing a decade ago. They blame it on a couple of things. One is drought and then floods, which is a genuine factor. But they say that it has been compounded not by the redistribution of farmland and the collapse of the economy, which has meant they haven't been able to import fertilizer, but rather it's Western sanctions led by Britain and what they describe as other racist countries aimed at overthrowing Mugabe and giving the land back to the white farmers.
And Mugabe has banned Western observers from monitoring this election, but it has allowed in foreign teams from those well-known bastions of freedom, Russia, Iran and China. Obviously, the last election in 2002 was marred by widespread allegations of vote rigging. Is it possible to determine whether it'll be the same this time?
We can only imagine that it'll be highly likely. There are some indicators, perhaps the best being, firstly, the padding of the voters' rolls, which has definitely happened. And also, there's been a lot of gerrymandering of parliamentary constituencies to, in effect, the core of opposition supporters boundaries in the cities. And what the government has done is to redraw the boundaries of constituencies to draw lots of rural voters into city constituencies in an effort to offset the opposition vote. But I think the government has a real task on its hands to rig the vote this time for a couple of reasons. Firstly, the situation economically is so much worse than it was 6 years ago. So the strength of anti-Mugabe feeling is much deeper. But also, Mugabe's facing a challenge from within his own party now, from the former finance minister, Simba Mokoni. Some prominent people in ZANU-PF have gone public in support of Mokoni. Others, Mokoni says, support him quietly behind the scenes. And I think Mr. Mugabe must be worried. He can't be certain that whatever rigging takes place will necessarily be in his favour and not in Mr. Mokoni's favour.
And has Mokoni got a formidable party machine behind him, though? Because he is standing as an independent, isn't he?
Yet he doesn't really have a party machine except that part of ZANU-PF that may be quietly working for him, which could yet prove quite formidable. It's not clear. There are no opinion polls to speak of. There's a lot of intimidation. Voters are scared to say what they intend to do, particularly in rural areas where they fear that if they don't voice support for ZANU-PF publicly, they won't get fed. But it could well be, like I say, that there are elements of the ZANU-PF machine working for Mokoni quite quietly. And the way the electoral system works, if anybody doesn't get an outright majority, there has to be a runoff. And it may well be that Mokoni, if he can force the third candidate, Morgan Tsvangirai, into third place, and there's a runoff with Mugabe, that may actually be when Mokoni comes into his own, and then Mr. Mugabe would face a real problem.
And what sort of a president might Mokoni make were he to be elected?
If he's anything like he was when he was the finance minister, I think he would pursue what certainly Western countries and the World Bank would consider more level-headed economic policies. He lost his job as finance minister because he told Mugabe that his economic policies were driving the country into the ground and would result in exactly what we've seen over the past few years with hyperinflation and mass unemployment. But Mokoni's quite clear on one very important issue to his potential constituency, which is that the land redistribution that's taken place will not be going back to the white farmers, and that he will find ways to make it productive. He says that a lot of the problems have to do with shortages of hard currency, and that in fact 60% of the maize that Zimbabwe produced 10 years ago was on communal lands, and that has declined and can be revived. So I think he's not abandoning Mugabe's land redistribution program. He's just going to make it work, in his words.
Chris, many thanks. 2 years ago, China introduced reforms to curb its use of the death penalty. At the time, state executions in China were thought to have accounted for 60% of the world's total. But this week, at the annual session of the National People's Congress, China's most senior judge said the reforms had been a success and that the number of state executions had fallen. Tanya Brannigan's in The Guardian's Beijing office. Tanya, what were these reforms?
Basically, they introduced a policy called kill fewer, kill carefully. And the idea was that they would give the Supreme Court the right to overturn capital sentences, which were handed down by the lower courts. But also, as well as actually showing that you could really change decisions that had been made at a lower level, the point was really also sending out a message, which was to say we shouldn't be using capital punishment as much as we are.
Because they weren't just using capital punishment to deal with crimes such as murder, were they?
No, I mean, it's still actually imposable in around, well, more than 60 offences, and those include non-violent offences, for example, corruption, drug smuggling, even sort of damaging national treasures, I believe, which can include killing a panda. Now, in fact, they weren't always used in those cases, I hasten to add, and certainly outside analysts say that since these reforms have been introduced, they think they're being used far less frequently, and that most cases now which are resulting in death sentences are generally the serious violent offences.
But Amnesty and other human rights groups have attacked China's lack of transparency on this. We don't actually know the number of people who have been executed.
No, absolutely. It's a state secret. And I have to say, even allowing for the fall in executions, which most independent analysts do seem to think is really pretty sizable, in 2006, which is the last year for which we have figures, it recorded over 1,000 executions. Now, those are the ones that appeared in the public domain. We have no idea what the actual total was, and external groups think that the real number is probably somewhere between maybe 6,000, 8,000 people.
Will the prisoners who are sentenced to death have received a fair trial in the People's Courts?
Well, this is the other really pressing issue which people are concerned about. It's not just a question of whether the death penalty is right or wrong, but people are saying, who knows whether it's being imposed on people who are actually guilty. The reason, in part, that these reforms were introduced in the first place was because there were a spate of very high-profile miscarriages of justice, and that was partly why the government decided that it had to sort of curb its use. If you speak to Amnesty, and if you speak actually to a lot of lawyers and even officials here, they'll say that broader legal reforms are desperately needed. Amnesty says, very simply, that nobody who's sentenced to death here receives a fair trial in terms of international human rights standards. They point out that there's a lack of access to lawyers, there's a lack of presumption of innocence, that there's political interference in the judiciary, that evidence extracted under duress or even torture is quite regularly admitted in courts.
And it's quite interesting, Tanya, that these reforms 2 years ago were introduced in response to public disquiet among the Chinese people about the use of the death penalty.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people here, and this includes people who've pressed for the reforms, still believe that the death penalty is needed at this stage. They're not saying it should be scrapped immediately, but what they are saying is that the country needs to move towards phasing out its use in the very long term.
Tanya Branigan reporting from Beijing. My name's John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Weekly, our reader Maggie Barclay's letter from Nicaragua, where she's been wrestling with the mud.
The mud is everywhere. And overwhelming. It's dark red, heavy with clay, slithery with shit from the pigs, chickens, a few cows and the odd mules that tread in it alongside the people.
But first, we're joined by Natalie Bennett, the editor of the print edition of Guardian Weekly. Natalie, welcome.
Thank you.
In this week's edition, Natalie, Sri Lanka, there's been elections there on Monday. What are we saying this week?
We've got a report from these elections, which are the local elections, the first one have been held in this area for 14 years, which has just been recovered from the Tamil Tigers. And a paramilitary group has had a sweeping victory in these, but we have some accounts from people in the town who are not very happy about the result and say that there's been an awful lot of violence and a lot of deaths associated with them.
And a comment piece from Le Monde, what to do about the fact that women don't get paid as much as men?
Yes, it seems. The solution is simple, John. What we have to do is just raise men's tax rates a very little bit, and we can then drop women's tax rates a great deal, and we'll end up with equity. This was actually a policy that was being pursued by, unfortunately, the losing side in the Spanish elections on the weekend, and I think I can safely predict we'll probably get some letters in reaction to this one. But what I really like about this is the writer comments that actually all of the academics running this proposal and opposing it are all male.
Now, one of my favourite albums at the moment, actually, is by Toumani Diabete, the Malian kora player. And we've got a portrait of him in this week's Guardian Weekly.
We do. This is in the culture section, and I think it's a lovely piece. Basically, he sits down in his back garden and talks about his life and what he thinks about the fact that he can trace his musical ancestors back through 71 generations. And then in the evening, he pops out to a dance club around about 2 a.m. So it sounds like quite a nice time was had by the journalist writing it.
And Guardian Weekly reports this week about an American healthcare scheme that's been employed in Australia to help Aborigine children and their mothers.
Yes, this is the Nurse Family Partnership, where 1,900 Indigenous families will be visited regularly in their home over a 5-year period by trained nurses. The visit will start during pregnancy and continue until the child is 2. I spoke to Dr. Paul Torzillo of the Nanampa Health Council in Central Australia about the program.
It's a very remote region. It's about 120,000 square kilometres with a total population of about 3,000 people. Young children in this area have low birth weights and they have much higher rates of infectious diseases. For example, in Central Australia, a decade or so ago, we reported the highest rates of invasive pneumococcal infection in the world. So these kids have really high rates of infectious diseases.
Now, what we're reporting is a new scheme that's being introduced, the Nurse Family Partnership. Can you tell me a little about that?
The Nurse Family Partnership is an organisation established in the US, but by a nurse visiting regularly during the antenatal period and for the next 2 years, you can produce really marked improved educational and social outcomes for both the children and the mothers. And Professor Old followed his first study group to 15 years, and shown that the benefits of this program persist for that long, both for mothers and children, with a range of social health benefits. Less problems with drugs, less problems with the criminal justice system, better education outcomes. So we've been keen, obviously, to take this evidence and see how it could be appropriately adapted for Indigenous children and mothers.
Because there have been some people who've expressed concern about importing this foreign scheme into a very different community. I know as a journalist many years ago in Australia, I reported on Aboriginal communities and there are very great cultural differences. Do you think there's a concern that you are bringing in something foreign, again, as many things foreign have been brought in before and have failed?
No, I don't think that at all. Quite obviously, this program would need to be adapted to whichever population it was taken into. The program's now being delivered or preparing to be delivered in 6 countries. Of course there'll be cultural and social adaptations that'll be necessary. I think at the moment Aboriginal kids in this country are really discriminated against by the health sector in a sense, in that there are very few things which have an evidence base. Almost all of the programs which are applied to these populations are based on personal prejudice, individual bias, rhetoric, or things which you wouldn't think about applying in a broad public health. I don't think that's acceptable anymore. I think that this population with the worst health status in the country should be getting the best evidence, the best advice, and we should be taking the best of international programs and seeing how they can be adopted in this country.
Dr. Paul Torzillo speaking to Guardian Weekly editor Natalie Bennett. We are embarking on a real voyage. That was what Jean-Jacques Dourdan, the Director General of the European Space Agency, said after the successful launch last weekend of an unmanned cargo vessel. Our science correspondent Ian Sample was at the launch site in French Guiana to meet Alan Thurkettle, the European Space Agency's Programme Manager for the International Space Station, and to see the rocket blast off.
It's just coming up to 1 o'clock in the morning here at the European Space Agency Spaceport in French Guiana. It's dark, it's wet, there are bats flying around, and we're surrounded by forest. About 5 kilometres away, and this is the nearest we can get, is an Ariane 5 rocket, and on top of that is Europe's largest and most complicated spacecraft yet. It's called the Automated Transfer Vehicle, and it's going to take 8 or so tonnes of cargo up to the International Space Station. It's suddenly gone very quiet here. We are now at 5 seconds. So in the distance you can see light, a really bright light, but no noise yet. It's up. It's incredibly bright. Here comes the noise. Sounds like the sky's ripping. That is the Ariane 5 crackling into the sky and leaving behind it an enormous plume of steam and smoke and into the cloud and on towards the International Space Station. Alan, could you just say, what is the ATV and what will it be used for?
The ATV is a 20-ton logistics carrier. It stands for the Automated Transfer Vehicle, but basically it's a truck that carries supplies and goods up to the station. It carries a mixture of dry cargo and fluids. The dry cargo are science samples, the spare parts for the station, equipment for the crew, medical equipment, clothing, food, that kind of stuff. It carries fluids. It can carry water, both Russian water and American water. There are 2 different types of water, believe it or not. It carries oxygen. It carries 2 types of propulsion fluids, one that it offloads onto the station, so the station has got its own attitude control when the ATV is not there, and also propulsion to reboost the station, to increase the altitude of the station, to offset the decay. So it's a multi-purpose logistics carrier for the station.
So what is quite special about the ATV in particular, technology-wise?
The unique thing about ATV is the A part. It's an automated vehicle. It is the first worldwide vehicle that's ever been able to automatically rendezvous and dock. Every other vehicle is piloted.
And this isn't a one-off. There are going to be more ATVs in the pipeline, hopefully.
more than hopefully. Contractually, there are more ATVs in the pipeline. We're building another four. We have a contract to build another four, which will satisfy our station commitments up until 2015. We're extremely optimistic that the station will extend well beyond 2015, and as optimistic that Europe will be a part of that. So therefore, there'll be future ATVs after that, simply as trucks for the station.
Ian Sample reporting from French Guiana. Prince Charles is visiting Jamaica this week. He's launching a £4 million plan to rebuild an area of Kingston that's been blighted by gang violence. The Guardian's Robert Booth spoke to community leaders in West Kingston about the problems they face and the task of regenerating the area.
Well, my name is Michael Black. I'm the president of the Rosetown Benevolent Society.
Describe what you're trying to do here.
Well, as you can see, we have a vast amount of open area. Our mission is to bring back physical structure to the community that the resident can feel that they are part of the society, because right now the space that I use up are mainly filled with rundown houses and so forth. So we are looking for some new housing stock, modern type housing, along with recreation area, sporting facilities and those stuff. So. Yeah. You know, everybody can be a part of this society.
And tell me what happened here to create what seems quite a desperate place now.
Well, in the 1970s, mainly 1976 to 1980, there was a big political warfare here that took place right in this area. And what it did, it divided the community into north and south. The north is more affiliated to the People's National Party, the South, the Jamaica Labour Party. So with all the fighting that was going on, these persons that were caught in the middle has to clear out.
And that's why we've got wilderness around.
Yes, because when they move out of the houses, people would come and scrap it down.
But then the hope was shattered. A little girl ran across the centre of the no man's land looking very upset, and she told us that a murder had just taken place in North Rose Town, just about 200 yards away. It turned out that a 20-year-old man called Donnie Hall had been gunned down in front of his friends and family in a hail of 9mm bullets. Mr. Black got straight onto the phone to find out what happened, explains the shooting.
There was a man who was going around with some guns. We're having a peace march today, actually. Yeah, we're going to march downtown to the waterfront. There will be a big concert in need of peace. So this man was going around with the T-shirt that person should be wearing, and somebody shoot him.
Later on, I catch up with Mark Shields, the Deputy Commissioner of the Jamaican Constabulary. He's a British police officer who has been working in Jamaica for some years now.
This is a classic day. You know, all of these, let's say three out of four are firearms related. The fourth is a stabbing and involves students. Yeah, this is a normal day.
Sure.
And then you've got another number of other shooting incidents here.
Not non-fatal ones.
Non-fatal. Yeah. Suicide and a firearm found. That's the sort of classic day in Jamaica. Yeah.
Robert Booth in Kingston. Every week we ask a reader or a listener to Guardian Weekly to give us an idea of what life's like where they are in the world. This week, mud wrestling, that is, wrestling with mud, with Maggie Barclay in Nicaragua.
Musawas doesn't have a post office or an internet cafe. Musawas is in the rainforest in the Bosawas Reserve in the North Atlantic Autonomous Region of Nicaragua and home to 2,000 Mayagnan Indians. It doesn't even seem to have a shop, unless you count the dark cubbyhole where you can buy a handful of thin white candles, a sachet of bleach, or a small packet of the highly coloured corn snacks that are popular with Nicaraguans and elsewhere sold by street vendors. And don't be fooled by the fridge at the back. It's the one solar-powered fridge in the village, and it contains medicines, not chilled beer. The bleach is perhaps a concession to some previous well-meaning helper's reaction to the mud. The mud is everywhere, and overwhelming. It's dark red, heavy with clay, slithery with shit from the pigs, chickens, a few cows and the odd mules that tread in it alongside the people. The houses are built upon stilts to keep them from the mud. With help from the outside world, Some modern conveniences have been installed in Musawas in the last 3 years. A pipe brings water down from the mountain opposite, over the Waspuk River, to 8 standpipes. One near the health centre, one near the school, and the rest in the barrios. There's a row of latrines, though I have to work up courage to use them. There's a raised concrete path that runs in a straight line from the vast Moravian church near one end of the village to the far end past the school. This path is a boon to my sister and me. We're in our only dry clothes, and the mud nearly defeats us with every step. We slip and slide and teeter. Since our hut is on the steep slope down to the Waspuk, I wish I'd taken more interest in learning how to ski when I had the opportunity, or had even learnt to balance on my son's skateboard. The trick is to move quickly and not worry about keeping clean. It's all I can do to remain upright when I brush my teeth near the path from the river, and I feel pathetic as three women chatter their way up the hill, buckets of water on their heads, barefoot and nimble in the squelchy mud. There's not much of a road between Musawas and the mining town of Bonanza, 30 kilometres away, and what there was has been badly damaged by Hurricane Felix. We spent 7 hours in the ambulance boat, a dugout canoe, to get here. Out of deference to our grey hair and thus great age, Orlando, one of the two Mayagnan leaders who accompanied us, decided we would trek round the places where the boatmen had to negotiate the rapids, some quaint notion of not getting our feet wet. Even though heavy rain showers pelted us from above and water from the Waspuk sloshed in the canoe. Soon we were wet from the inside as well as outside, sweating from hot scrambles in the mud on a steep slope over fallen trees and under creepers. We learned a bit late in the day that Was, as in Bosawas, Musawas, Waspuk, is the Mayagnan word for water. My toes had turned into lurid white prunes. I wondered about the Mayagnan men in their short wellingtons, who nonchalantly empty them of water in a sort of forward-leaning arabesque. I doubt either their feet or the boots ever dry out. Putting wet clothes back on for the return journey was momentarily unpleasant, and our boots oozed. We waded the rapids this time, but darkness came too quickly for the boat, and we had to leave it and trek across muddy fields under another torrential downpour. In the little plane from Bonanza to Managua next day, I made a mental note to remember one more set of dry clothes and have a go on a skateboard before the next time.
Maggie Barclay's letter from Nicaragua. Guardian Weekly's producer is Matt Haywood. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.